Good afternoon. My name is Nathan Ramsey, and I'm Executive Director of Land of Sky Regional Council. And I want to welcome you to our weekly Land of Sky COVID-19 call. The purpose of these calls are to share information and to help our region better respond to the COVID-19 public health and economic crisis that is gripping our region, as well as our state and nation. We've been holding these calls since April, so we appreciate all those who've listened over the last several months, and we hope they've been beneficial to you. Today, we're going to have Drew Christie with the governor's office. Will give us a brief update. We appreciate Drew sharing with us. Then later on, we'll have a presentation from Matthew Martin, who's vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, and also Chris Wall, who's with EQV Strategic. He'll give us an update of state legislative updates. These calls are recorded, so please bear that in mind. We're muting everyone that joins the call. So if you have any questions, you please enter that into the chat box, or you can text me at 828-768-3216. That's 828-768-3216. So Governor Cooper made several announcements yesterday, and and over the last several days, some pretty big announcements have come from the governor's office. So I'll turn it over to Drew Christie, his Western representative, to give us an update and a report from Governor Cooper.
Hey, Nathan, thank you for having me, and thank you to Land of Sky Regional Council for hosting these. Before I get into the governor's budget proposal and some coronavirus funding for residents and local governments, I'll go through some numbers here. As of today, there have been 161,076 lab-confirmed cases. There have been 2.1 million tests completed, and we have seen a dip in hospitalizations that is down to 958 total people in the hospital. Changing over to unemployment, there have been, North Carolina has paid out a total of $7.1 billion in unemployment insurance. There have been a total of 2.2 million claims filed with a total of 1.25 million claimants. And to break all these numbers down, and I actually do believe North Carolina has one of the best completion rates in our unemployment as of now. So we currently only have 1% of our total claimants pending resolution for state benefits, and for numbers purposes, that's 17,398. And we only have 2% of people, of claimants, not approved for state benefits, but are pending resolution for federal benefits. So that's just shy of 30,000. And so the state has paid, there have been 70% of all claimants have been paid, and only 27% of all claimants have not been eligible for any benefits. So we have drastically closed the gap in making sure that everyone who has filed for unemployment gets a response back, whether they are approved or not approved. So again, it's a total of 3% that are left pending resolution, either for state or federal benefits. So that's very good news there. So the governor's announcement yesterday, he rolled out his budget proposal. And so I'll run through just quickly some of the top line items here. We must expand the quality of healthcare, or access to the quality of healthcare, by expanding Medicaid. So the governor's lobbying for that. We want to make sure that we get those federal dollars that we as North Carolinians are paying to Washington but are not getting back. The 38 other states that have expanded Medicaid are getting those dollars that we as taxpayers have paid into the system, but we are not seeing the benefits of those. So governors encouraging the legislature to expand Medicaid. We must increase our state unemployment benefits, which are among the stingiest in the country, by extending the maximum number of weeks from 12 to 24 and upping the maximum benefits to $500 per week instead of $350 per week. You know, we must support educators who are doing more than ever to teach, feed, and care for our children. In the absence of recurring funds to give them a much deserved raise, we must give them a bonus compensation reflective of their evolving responsibilities, which the governor is asking for a $2,000 bonus for all teachers that did not receive a raise this past budget cycle. We must meet the state's constitutional responsibility to provide a sound basic education to every North Carolina child by investing in support for children with disabilities, disadvantaged and at-risk students, and the Teaching Fellows Program. We must continue to build our COVID-19 response with more testing, tracing, and prevention efforts, while also investing in world-class development of vaccines and treatments in North Carolina. We must bridge the digital learning gap and bring opportunities to rural areas by expanding internet access, improving healthcare, and investing in rural infrastructure. We must help struggling families and businesses weather the storm of COVID-19 with rental and utilities assistance. And I'll cover more about that here in just a second. And lastly, we must plan for the future by taking advantage of historically low interest rates to make deep investments in infrastructure while building 21st century schools, more housing, and improving water and sewer infrastructure. And so that's just kind of the top line stuff, not delving too deeply into the governor's proposed budget. If you have any questions specifically about that, I would refer you to the governor's budget plan, which is online. You can find that through the most recent press release. Or if you have specific questions, let me know in the chat box. I'll be happy to answer them for you. And now moving into the announcement the governor made on Tuesday in regards to $175 million that is through the CDBG-CV, the Community Development Block Grant Coronavirus Program. And so Governor Cooper announced $175 million to help North Carolinians with rental and utility payment support in wake of COVID-19. And so it's broken up into basically three different categories here. Eviction prevention and utility payments, approximately $94 million of the funding will be dispersed by the North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency, NCOR, to support rental and utility payments and the prevention of evictions for those who with a demonstrated need. The funding will be distributed to eligible community agencies around the state and will work directly with North Carolinians on an application and disbursement process. The funds include $28 million from the federal CDBG-CV funding and the remaining $66 million from the CARES Act, CRF, the Coronavirus Relief Fund money. So that's part one. Part two is the crisis response and housing stability. About $53 million of the funding is designated for emergency solution grant, coronavirus, ESGCV, which is a program through the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. This federal money is intended for families experiencing homelessness or who face a more immediate risk of homelessness, and will be distributed by similar community agencies handling the in-course program. So that's part two. And then part three, which is most applicable for everyone on this call, is the local governments fund. Another $28 million of federal funding will be administered by local governments through the North Carolina Department of Commerce. This money comes from the federal CDBG CV program and will be administered and incorporated administered by incorporated municipalities under 50,000 residents and counties under 200,000 residents that apply to participate. Local governments are encouraged to prioritize the money locally to help their residents pay rent and outstanding utility bills. In addition, the funds may provide support for internet access, food distribution, COVID-19 testing and diagnosis, and employment training for healthcare workers. So all of that final piece, the $28 million, is done through the North Carolina Department of Commerce. So if you go to their website, you'd be able to find more information out about that. The application for that local government funds will be open September the 1st. So I definitely encourage everybody to look at that now and get your ducks in a row to start the application process. And with that, Nathan, I'll turn it back over to you for any questions you may have.
Thank you so much, Drew, for that update from the governor's office. We really appreciate it. It's good news to hear that the progress being made on unemployment claims. I know there were some claims that had gone back several months and people were struggling. So so hopefully I know the Division of Employment Security is ramped up their capacity to try to handle those. So we're grateful to see progress is being made there. Our Land of Sky Regional Council is working with councils of government in the western part of the state and other stakeholders, as well as our local governments, to see if how can we take advantage of the funds through those are available through the North Carolina Department of Commerce, through the CDBG funds, and through rental assistance and others. So hopefully we'll be ready by September 1st, and either for the local governments that want to proceed on an application on their own, we will certainly support those local governments if they need technical assistance. But we also there may be an opportunity for regional applications as well. So we'll start that conversation, and we appreciate the update that you provided. I was talking to you a little before the call about it's a little different to have a budget proposal released in a at this time of year, and you were explaining some of these funds are CARES Act funds, some are funds from a rainy day, some are unexpended funds that carried over because the state didn't adopt a updated budget in 2020. Is that correct, Drew?
That is correct, Nathan. And, I don't know where each specific line item, where that funding is coming from. Of course, the top, the more COVID-19 related stuff is going to be coming from the CARES Act and federal funding, of course. I do know the $2,000 bonuses to teachers are going to be coming from the non-recurring items from our rainy day fund. So that means that the tax there will be no increase, no new taxes to pay for the teacher bonuses. And so, beyond that, I don't know. And all of that's broken down in the budget document.
And we'll, and Chris Wall is supposed to join our call later on, and he will, he might have some additional information that he can share, from a state legislative or federal legislative update. So, Drew, that's a lot of information. We'll look forward to continue working with you and any of our members of our public, local governments, businesses, others that have any questions. I know you're always willing to reach out to them and take those calls. So, again, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Nathan.
I now want to introduce Matthew Martin, who's the Vice President of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. Vice President Martin is a graduate of West Point. Prior to his time at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, he was senior economist at Moody's Analytics, and he was an analyst for the Congressional Budget Office. The Federal Reserve Bank is Richmond serves multiple states from Maryland, I think, through the Carolinas. And Vice President Martin oversees the bank's outreach efforts in North and South Carolina. So, Vice President Martin, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Nathan. Can you hear me okay?
We can, and we've got your presentation, and we're getting ready to upload that. So is that appearing on your screen?
It is. Thank you very much. So I assume someone else is driving, and I can just say next slide.
That is correct. So thank you so much for joining us, and we appreciate your leadership. And if you want to give people a little background on the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, you're welcome to do that. Thank you, Vice President Martin.
I'll do that, and I'll count on you to keep me on time in case I run over. I'd like to have a little time for questions and discussion and feedback, so I'll try to go through this at a pretty good pace. A couple of disclaimers first. I'm speaking for myself, not necessarily anyone else in the Federal Reserve System. That's just in case I say something stupid. It's not attributable to them. It's my own words. And my second disclaimer, when we get to the regional part, I'll start with a little bit of a national outlook. The data sources we have are limited, particularly on anything that's like a monthly frequency. So you'll see Asheville MSA data, and as I understand it, your region includes Transylvania County, but not Hayward. So there's a little bit of a difference, and there's just no easy way to pull in a different county that way. And it's a shame. I love Transylvania County. My own affinity is, you can tell when someone likes something by where they spend their time. And I get up your way a lot. Get to fish in the mountains occasionally. Although, actually, I think that's just, we drive through Transylvania. I think that's just into Jackson County, the headwaters of the Tuckasegee. Great place.
Oh, wow. We're glad you're able to join our region. Our transportation programs actually do include Haywood.
Okay.
If you're correct, the official COG region is Buncombe, Madison, Henderson, and Transylvania. But we are part of the COG. We house our Metropolitan Planning Organization, which oversees transportation projects in the region. And we do serve Haywood in that role.
Okay, great. Just one more comment. My affinities are just to the west a little more these days. In Jackson County, my son just started as a freshman at Western Carolina. And so we've had quite a few trips up there over the last few months and really enjoy spending time up there as well. So what I want to do is just spend a little bit giving you the context at the national level, and you can go to the next slide. And then bring it down to the regional level. When I get to the regional level, I think there is both a challenge and an opportunity that I'll highlight. There may be more than that, obviously, in current circumstances, but a couple of things that have come to light. the background is, so I'm part of I work for the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. I'm based out of our Charlotte office, and as Nathan mentioned, cover the Carolinas. So we play a number of roles, all of which we do out of Charlotte. Monetary policy is what we're known for, and my role broadly supports that. I'm charged with having a real-time read on what's happening on the ground in the economies of North Carolina and South Carolina. So I spend a lot of time talking to business and banking community leaders across the two-state region. We brief our president on a regular basis on what's happening, and he's talking to a lot of business leaders as well. We do have a bank supervision role, and in Charlotte, as you might imagine, a lot of our large banking supervision group is based, because we have BB&T Truist, Bank of America, and we've got a couple others in that portfolio, most notably Capital One. And then we're involved in payments, and we've got one of the larger cash operations in Charlotte. We do process coin. You've probably heard about coin shortages. We get those both cash and coin into circulation. We are not responsible for printing or minting either one of those. And if there's interest, we can talk about some of the challenges going there. So my role is mostly in this economic and monetary policy realm. So you see a quick summary here. And what I'd say is what we're noticing now is after the economy bottomed out in April, there was a partial but fairly rapid recovery through June or so. In July, things started to slow down as far as pace of recovery, to the point where as case loads built again, we saw a bit of a flatlining of economic data. And I think it's a real concern now because we're in August. You were just talking about unemployment insurance. The supplemental program from the federal government, the $600 a week, has ended. The support from the initial checks that were put out May, has largely been spent out. And so there's a bit of a concern that some of the early stimulus that was designed to help both businesses and individuals bridge this time period has run out. And then you see some pullback in activity additionally, as there were concerns about, particularly in our region, the pickup in cases. So that's what we're looking at now. And that's at the national level. The path of the virus is going to matter and the availability of responses to it. But those policy supports are going to be important. When you get to the regional level, the key points I'll make here is that this is a very atypical episode, as you probably all know in your region. A normal recession, the manufacturing sector gets hit hard. Services tend to hold up a little bit better on the whole, although travel and tourism may suffer. This time it's been flipped on its head, right? Manufacturing, not that some of those haven't seen declines in demand and job losses, but have held up much better than the service industry, particularly entertainment, restaurants, hotels, all that leisure hospitality stuff. And I think that's going to present the challenge will be a workforce challenge going forward. But it's clear, and I keep hearing these stories, that people from gateway cities or more dense urban areas, who particularly young professionals who can work from anywhere, they're making decisions that if they can work from anywhere, they would rather work in a place that is away from the big city. And I think that represents an opportunity for the region. So I'll get to that. If you go to the next slide, we'll quickly go through some data here. And this is the real GDP numbers. And the dark blue bars are quarter-to-quarter changes at an annual rate. And that's important because when you look at that Q2 20, we just got a revision this morning. So instead of minus 32.9, it's minus 31 and change percent. So a little bit better. But it doesn't mean almost a third of the economy disappeared in the second quarter. It's presented at an annual rate. So it says, I don't know why we do it that way. It's not how I would do it if I were in charge, but it means you know, roughly divide by four. But over the first two quarters of the year, the economy has declined more than 10%. The third quarter is going to be a pretty strong rebound, but not as strong as the decline in the first two quarters. So most forecasters are expecting somewhere in the 20 to closer to 30% range rebound. So let's say it's 25. That's still going to leave us short, and we'll probably be down for the year 4 to 5%. But I think this is predicated on a vaccine becoming widely available, and most forecasters put that in, say, by the middle of next year. If that happens and we have a little bit more opening up in the economy, more consumer confidence, 21 could be a pretty strong growth year as we continue to rebound. One thing I think will happen, though, and this shows up when you look at the unemployment data on the next page, on the next slide, is that the business recovery already seems to be front-running the labor market recovery. So pretty sharp downturn. Depending on the industry you're in, it could have been really bad or fairly marginal, or if you're like Lowe's, your business is up for the year because everybody's been at home doing home improvement projects. But if your business is down, say, 10-15% revenue-wise compared to last year, most businesses have either trimmed their costs, which includes labor, or are in the process of doing so, so that they'll be profitable at this 90% or so level of revenue. And there's a lot of optimism from business leaders that I hear. But it does mean that unemployment, sort of the more permanent unemployment, that continues to roll out. I don't know if you saw the news. American Airlines, I think 30,000 job cuts. Charlotte's going to bear a big chunk of those, and I think that's going to happen in September. So some of these more permanent job cuts are yet to come, and that's going to provide some headwinds for the labor market. And you see here the unemployment rate, after peaking near 15%, has receded to just over 10. The forecast you see there is from members of the Federal Open Market Committee. That's the monetary policymakers. Next month they'll update it. This one's from June. The widest bars show you the widest range of their forecast for year-end unemployment rates. So it's a pretty wide range, but the sort of central tendency of it, even by the end of next year, we're looking at something like 7% unemployment. So still elevated. It's going to take a couple of years for employment to get back down. And in the meantime, we have a secondary problem. You only count as unemployed if you're looking for work. If you go to the next slide, we've had a pretty sizable chunk of the labor force that is out of the labor force, meaning they don't have a job and they're no longer looking for work. Labor force participation has dropped a bit, and at the national level, it's about the labor force is about 4.5 million workers smaller than it was in February, and it's an open question of why and if those workers are coming back. Lots of different stories. Older workers who are more at risk deciding not to come back to work. Those with kids, to think of a two-income family, and kids are not going to school, at least not full-time in a lot of places. So how do you handle childcare? Or if you have preschool kids, how do you handle childcare? So we hear a lot of stories like that. So unemployment's elevated. The labor force has shrunk. That sounds like a recipe where the consumer spending sector is going to be problematic. And that does show up in the data if you go to the next slide. But to date, government transfer programs, so the stimulus checks and the enhanced unemployment benefits, have actually raised disposable personal income so far, but spending has declined nonetheless. And so some of that is people fearful of the future, conserving cash. Some of it is particularly in higher income households who would have gone out to dinner, gone to concerts and stuff. They're not doing that, and they're not replacing that spending. So the red line is year-over-year change in income. It's gone up so far, and we'll get the July numbers later this week, tomorrow, I think. That would be later this week. But spending's down. The one place spending isn't down is for goods. So if you go to the next slide, retail sales, which is sales of goods, and this includes online sales, have recovered to where they're up over last year, and that's pretty positive. So again, it's the services where we're seeing the sharp decline. And then the last thing I'll cover is on the housing front. If you go to the next slide, this is new single family home sales during the periods of the shutdown. Obviously, it was hard to sell a home. That has rebounded strongly. And what's interesting is realtors have figured out how to sell homes remotely, right? You can, and I've heard a lot of stories of people, particularly coming from the Northeast or the upper Midwest, buying homes in North Carolina, sight unseen. The realtor FaceTimes them through the house, and so they see it virtually. Closing is done virtually. Everything is done virtually, and you've got your house. The biggest ones I've heard were in Charlotte, one of the upscale neighborhoods, a couple of stories of $2 million homes, New Yorkers buying sight unseen. And then I heard a story of a couple from Ohio buying beachfront property in Hilton Head Island, $7 million property, and they never saw it in person. So that'll feed into my opportunity for the region when we get to that. So let me turn to the regional economy. And the first thing I'm going to, you can go two slides ahead, please, to the next data slide. This was so fast moving, especially at first in March, April, and May, that we, like a lot of other organizations, started to look at some higher frequency non-traditional data. And so this is one source. I will note that if you go to our website, richmondfed.org, we update this weekly. We call it the Pandemic Pulse. So every Friday, most of the data is, maybe all of it's weekly data, it gets updated. So this is the latest one. And Homebase is a company that serves mostly small businesses with payroll, et cetera. So it's not a complete census of businesses, but it gives you some read on what's happening. And you can see North Carolina is the dark blue here. If it had been my druthers, I'd made it purple given my recent affiliation, but that's another story. And you can see that mid-April was really for the Carolinas the bottom as far as here with business openings. And from mid-April on, pretty strong recovery in business openings until we get to mid-June, and then it sort of flatlines. And if you go to the next slide, you see a similar pattern for hours worked for employees in these businesses as well. South Carolina moving a little faster. They opened up earlier than North Carolina, and that's reflected in the data. And we're seeing this, I think, at a national level, and this is concerning. I'm getting not too many reports yet, but I'm paying attention to things like rent collections for multifamily property owners. So the $600 has ended, the other stimulus is trailing off, and the moratorium on evictions is ending as well. And I'm starting to hear that rental collections this month ran a little bit behind July. So that starts to get concerning as we go into September, if we don't have another fiscal package. So that's something to pay attention to. So if you go to the next slide, then we'll get down more regionally with the payroll data. And so here you have the two state regions showing year-over-year change in payroll data. For comparison, this is data through July. The national rate, it was over 7% down. So both Carolinas are doing a little bit better than what we're seeing nationally. South Carolina faring a little bit better than North Carolina. But the July data showed a definite slowdown in the pace of recovery in payroll numbers. If we look at the Asheville MSA specifically on the next slide, I've broken it down into two pieces. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot about this slide. So just looking at the regional dispersion of what's going on with payroll, North Carolina and Asheville represented there. So the payroll decline is pretty significant in Asheville, more so than most other MSAs. What's interesting to me is that the best performing MSAs are generally, they are smaller ones, but smaller ones who aren't dependent on leisure and hospitality industry. Jacksonville's got something funny going on with local employment, but they did see a jump in federal. So they're gearing up to accept the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. I don't know if it's related to that. But the other ones listed there, it's a reflection of industry structure. They have significant manufacturing components that have held up better. I would caution that this is one labor market survey, the payroll survey. For some MSAs, you get a different picture when you look at the household survey. I'll take one example, Goldsboro. Their payroll is down 10.4%, roughly where Asheville is, but their unemployment rate's only 6.6%. So there's some labor force participation issues that are factoring in there. And payroll, I think, is probably a little bit more steady measure of what's happening with actual employment. But you can see that change. The larger metro areas, Raleigh in particular, has had a fairly steep decline over this period. So now let's look at Asheville specifically. And I've broken out services and manufacturing. And you can see the difference there, where manufacturing is down almost 6% in payroll employment. But that's far less than what you all saw during the Great Recession. So for manufacturing, it sort of feels like a mild recession. But for services, it feels like a Great Depression sort of level of unemployment. And I think this is where the workforce challenge comes in. The longer we go where we don't have a recovery in some of those industries, the more likely it is there'll be permanent displacements out of those industries. And I don't know that it's easy to take someone who's a hotel worker and get them ready for advanced manufacturing, for example, just to take one example. So I think there's a workforce challenge that we're going to be presented with that's going to be somewhat different than what we've seen in the past. Probably for 20 years or more in the Carolinas, we've worried about the loss of traditional manufacturing and how to transition those workers into service sectors. Now we're talking about lower wage service workers and where are we going to find employment for that type of worker. I think that's a challenge. I think there's maybe a generational challenge. So young workers, maybe those who are even school age, enrollments are down at colleges and definitely down at community colleges. I'm not sure what those young people are doing. Employment's going to be hard to find, and they're not getting skill development as well. So this isn't unique to your region, but the service sector hit is bigger, and so in that sense it might be a little bit more of a challenge. So not to end the regional portion on a down note, if you go to the next slide, this is the reason for the particular locations listed here I'll get to in a second, but I've been pondering this idea of internal migrations, meaning internal to the U.S. And I know a lot of this has often centered on cost structure. So if you compare Asheville to Charlotte, not surprising for any of you, given the rough terrain up there, housing can be expensive. But I don't, a couple of things occurred to me. It's really not that expensive when you compare it to some of the places people are coming from. And I purposely didn't list the really high cost metro areas. We all know New York and San Francisco are really expensive. But I mentioned that I've heard a lot of stories about in migration. I was just talking to a realtor end of last week who had worked with a relatively young professional couple moving out of Chicago, and they were looking at Blowing Rock, I think, was the place that he was looking at homes with them. And Chicago, depending on where you are, could be a pretty high cost area, but it really didn't have anything to do with the cost structure. It was they're making a decision. We're not working in an office. We've been told we can work from just about anywhere going forward. Where do we want to be? And so the decision is much broader than a cost structure or need to be near an employer. I think that individual decision is part of this. Then there is going to be another piece of this. And I'm hearing from those that like Office Space REIT and others that they're getting a lot of discussion from employers in the big gateway cities that they might do a hub and spoke model, still have a headquarters in the big city, but regional offices. And who knows where they'll put those. Charlotte might be an example there. But there's this possibility that for some period of time, we're going to see an adjustment of where companies and people are going to live and work. And I think that's something everybody should be ready for. I think one probably must have is the availability of broadband, reliable, real broadband, which obviously Asheville has, but maybe some surrounding communities might be a little bit more challenging. So let me go to the next slide, and I won't spend too much time here. A quick word or two on the policy response. Healthcare has been in the lead, and really a vaccine is going to be important down the road, and there's lots of encouraging news there. Fiscal supports will also be important. We as monetary policymakers can move fast, but we really don't have the tools that are directly available to support this. If there's interest, I can talk a little bit. I'm not a full expert on some of our lending programs. It does include a municipal facility, as I understand it. To date, only Illinois and New York have participated in that facility, but that is available. I will note this morning, if you weren't watching the news, Chair Powell rolled out the Fed's new monetary policy framework, and this might be of some interest down the road. What it includes, and I'm going to read it verbatim, is a change in our interest or our inflation target, which since 2012 has been a target of 2%. And now we're going to seek to achieve inflation that averages 2% over time. So that means following periods when inflation's been running below 2%, appropriate monetary policy will likely aim to achieve inflation moderately above 2% for some time. So to put that in plain English, if we're seeing inflation, as has been the case, consistently under our 2% target, we're going to undertake policy changes to try and push that above 2%. And that has implications then for interest rates and other things that might be important to some of the work you're doing. And then finally, in the last slide, there are a lot of unknowns out there. So trying to project economic activity is difficult, but it's gonna matter, I think, a great deal if we have a vaccine or vaccines that get out there and are effective. I think that's eventually our way forward. And this time next year could be very different than what we're seeing now. If you could just go to the next slide, then that's just a reference to where some of our resources are on our webpage. And I'll also note, just by way of promotion, on October 8th, we are holding our second annual Investing in Rural America conference. It will be virtual this year. And our regional economist out of our Charlotte office, Laura Ulrich, has been the one to put that together. So it's got lots of North Carolina participation in it. And I would be happy to send you the registration link for that conference if you're interested. So with that, let me stop and see if there are any questions or discussion.
Vice President Martin, thank you so much for that really informative presentation. Certainly, we would love to be able to share the registration link for that, for your rural conference. You know, the uniqueness of our area is we have a little bit of everything here. So we have some urban areas in the Asheville-Hendersonville corridor that may be similar to some larger communities. But then we have very rural places like Rosman or Hot Springs that are quite remote. So even though we have Asheville and Hendersonville and some urban areas, you know, our region and Western North Carolina generally are really rural. And so I think that would be very informative to us. Just a few questions to follow up, really helpful presentation. You know, prior to the COVID-19 really hitting us in March, for 61 consecutive months, our region had maintained the lowest unemployment rate of any place in North Carolina. And that ended in April, and there for a time, we were near the top of unemployment in the state. And, you know, I think part of that's because we've been harder hit in the service sector. But on the workforce side, what we're sort of seeing is a dichotomy. So on one side, we still have a good number of employers searching for workers, but we still have 20,000 people unemployed. So could you sort of give any thoughts that you have? That I can't ever remember a time, even in 2009, we saw more of a rush to our career centers and community colleges than we're seeing now. With, you know, even though our unemployment rate has gone down, we're still pretty close to where we were in the peak of 2009, the Great Recession. So I don't know if that's just unique to COVID, or what are your thoughts there?
Sorry, my home phone rang, and so I muted myself. Couldn't unmute. That's a really good point, and we are hearing that more broadly, that even in other places with high unemployment rates, that workers, particularly manufacturers that have seen an increase in demand, are having a hard time recruiting workers. And so what's clear is we've got some frictions in the labor market where those who are unemployed either aren't interested, don't feel they're suited or for the work, or some other barrier that's preventing them from crossing over industries to take on those jobs. But it includes things that aren't necessarily higher skill based. So if you think, when I think about advanced manufacturing or machining work or other stuff like that, yeah, you've got, it takes time to develop those workers. But I talked to a company that makes wipes, right? So they make cleaning supplies for businesses and hospitals, and they just need people to stack these wipes to get them ready for shipment. And they can't find those kind of workers either. And they're working with, I think, three different recruiters. So that's a real problem in the near term. And some of that might be an informational thing. Some of it just might be people don't want to do that kind of work. But I find that hard to believe that down the line, particularly if there's not another stimulus package, that there won't be workers out there desperate to find something. But that is a puzzle.
Where do you land? I know a lot of economists are sort of over the map on this, but I know the president of the Minneapolis Fed is been pretty outspoken regarding wage levels. And you, I think there was a comment of, well, do you have a company that says they have 100 job openings they can't fill? Well, is that because they can't fill those job openings because there's not the skill or talent there? Or is that because, you know, they're not paying a competitive wage? And it seems like in our region, and maybe this is anecdotal, we've lost more of those middle wage jobs in this recession. I know our service sector was hit, and those tend to be a little lower paying. But a lot of the jobs that we do have now tend to be on those entry levels. So they may be in the $13 to $14 to $20 an hour range, but we don't have as many of those higher paid jobs. I don't know if you've seen that in other places in the Carolinas where the jobs are coming back.
Yeah, I have. And I think more generally, even absent this COVID episode, I think there's been a hollowing out of some of those middle wage jobs, right? And so it's moved to more of a barbell distribution. and the lower end of the barbell has been hit especially hard. So I think these are real issues. I'm looking at the what's coming in from the chat. Is there a concern about infection control and managing employee concerns? I think that's real. I've heard that from a couple of employers who will admit that some of their employees are concerned about getting infections when they come to work. And then, of course, older workers. At the national level, you can look at the labor force participation data and break it down by age. Not by age and industry, but at least by age. So you can track labor force participation and see if it's the older workers who are pulling back more. I haven't done that, but that's something that's relatively easy to do. I feel like I left out a part of your question, Nathan.
I mean, I think I was just wondering if that was just my perception that really is not based in fact, or if you're seeing a trend of that. So, you know, job opening data is a little hard to say pinpoint on how many job openings do we have today in our five county metro region. But, you know, prior to COVID, we felt like we had somewhere around 15,000 job openings on any given day in our region. You know, we certainly don't have that number because pretty much every employer at that time was hiring, and we know we've seen some pretty significant job losses in some sectors, but it just seems like a lot of the companies that are in great demand for hiring now, it tends to be those lower wage jobs. I think they are, those entry-level wage jobs have gone up, and you saw that prior to COVID-19, where there was a lot of pressure on the, you know, entry-level jobs because the labor market was so tight. But I just didn't know if you've seen that trend in other places in the Carolinas, or maybe that's an outlier here.
No, that trend is broader. And to put it in context, so take a manufacturer that sells, maybe they either directly or as a supplier, into a company selling to Walmart. Walmart's going to tell them, you're not raising prices ever, right? So they have to manage it, that, and that actually goes back to, if you look at the last 10 years, the way inflation expectations have formed in an environment where the Fed has said, we have a 2% inflation target, but we've always underrun it. Then Walmart will go back and say, you're going to get 2% productivity efficiency every year. So my expectation is you're not raising prices. And so the employer is going to say, well, I really can't raise wages very easily then unless I get 3 or 4% productivity. So there's, I wonder going forward, a couple of things. So outside of timber and some others, a lot of commodity prices are lower. Some of this may shake loose, and particularly for high demand industries, we may see wages move a little bit more. The other thing I have seen is certainly early on, employers were paying sort of hazard pay type extras to compensate employees who were essential and working. Those are the kinds of things that once you do them, they're hard to pull them back. So that might translate into somewhat higher wages for some of the workers you're talking about, and maybe eventually that pulls some more workers in. I think it is a big problem to solve. I think you're not alone in facing that issue in your region.
We just have a few more minutes. The economists talk about this concept of, and I've mispronounced it every time, but agglomeration. Mm-hmm. So there's been this trend of companies to migrate to bigger metros, bigger cities. And, you know, you did see a real divergence of these superstar cities or high-flying areas like in North Carolina, the Triangle and the Charlotte region were, you know, up there nationally as far as performance and job growth and other things. Asheville actually was doing pretty well considering the size of our metro, and we were probably punching above our weight. But to your point earlier, and we hear those anecdotal stories about people moving into our region from Chicago and New York and other places buying homes as a result of this. Do you see but that trend to urban areas has been really a century-long trend or even beyond, and it's been a global trend. Do you see this changing that, where it could help more rural places like Western North Carolina?
I think it's a possibility. So I think certainly over the next year or two anyhow, there's going to be some flows away from those really large gateway metro areas. And a place like a Charlotte or Raleigh will certainly benefit from that. It will be interesting to see where within a Charlotte metro area companies locate. So obviously the Central Business District has extended down South End in Charlotte. Lowe's has put their IT center there. There's a fair amount of density, but it may be that the surrounding communities end up benefiting, right? So maybe these companies don't need to be in the Central Business District. This would have been in development before COVID, but the Centene announcement in Charlotte, they're going to be out by the university area. So that's not full on suburbs, I guess, but it's moving in that direction. So then I wonder if there will be some that will consider even smaller metro areas and probably not the really large economic development projects, but I can imagine that a region like Asheville will be more competitive than maybe we've seen in the past for some of those deals. It will be fascinating to watch. I certainly think when you get outside and talk about manufacturing and distribution, some of those sorts of things, 26 and 40 give you access to the highways you need to get stuff, goods moved down the road. I think that's definitely feasible. Certainly Hickory's getting some attention for that sort of thing, I think. So I think there's possibilities. I'd be hard pressed to say how successful you'll be. It's too soon to tell, I think.
But our region is, approaching about 500,000 people, and generally the regions that are 1 million, 2 million, 3 million or more, we're able to track those larger projects, and I don't know what that impact will be, but so far, we've still seen some. There's expansion. You mentioned distribution. Just at our Board of Delegates meeting yesterday, there was discussion. Amazon's building a distribution center between Asheville and Hendersonville and Mills River. Lowe's is building a distribution center in that similar area. So that might align with what you're talking about. So Vice President Martin, we really appreciate you being with us today. I hope it's been helpful for you. It's certainly been helpful for us. If it's okay, could we post your PowerPoint on our website to share with others?
Yes, you may. And I will send you the link to our rural conference as well. Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Well, thank you so much. So we will share those resources. Before we end the call, just want to remind everyone of you can find those resources on our Land of Sky COVID page. That's at landofsky.org/COVID-19. You can find that on our homepage. Chris Wall was unable to join us. I knew he was going to join us a little later in the call. He had another engagement, but he thought he could break away. We did get a question in the chat about PPP loan forgiveness. I know there's a lot of discussion about that right now. There's been some talk about forgiveness for all loans under $150,000. There was just an article in the Triangle or Charlotte Business Journal about SBA's concern that if you forgive all the loans under a certain threshold, there may be fraud that's happening. So there have been reports of some people using their PPP loans to go buy, a house or sports cars or things like that. So I think there is some effort, bipartisan effort to address that, but and I don't know if something will happen before the election. Chris shared with us at our last report. I think the Chief of Staff Meadows yesterday was reporting the news that he's offered to Speaker Pelosi to restart negotiations. But I don't know if, I know Chris was like I was. I thought we would have a fourth CARES package prior to the November elections. And that would be our last big package before the election. But that hasn't happened yet just due to political gridlock in D.C. So hopefully on next week's call, Chris can give us an update. We're certainly advocating for our state and local governments. North Carolina is in better shape than most other states. But North Carolina is reported looking at $3 to $5 billion shortfall. Good news is North Carolina has a good bit of reserves and unspent funds, but even still, it will be difficult. Our local governments are facing similar challenges. So if something doesn't happen, there will be significant negative consequences in that regard. So certainly we're advocating for that and doing the best we can with our federal and state partners. But I just want to thank everyone for joining our call today. Again, stay safe, stay well. And we will have another call next week. I think we may cancel the call on September 10th, but on September 17th, Dr. Michael Walden with NC State University will join us. Dr. Walden, like Vice President Martin, are two of the preeminent economic thinkers in our state, in our region. And they understand a lot of the moving parts and can better help us navigate these challenging times. So we just appreciate all y'all joining us. Hope you have a wonderful day. And again, thank you for everything you do for our region. If you need to reach out to me, you're welcome to do that at any time at nathan@landosky.org. So stay safe, stay well, and have a wonderful day.